The Missoula County attorney hopes to resolve a dispute with the Federal Justice Department without going to court. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about the kickoff to the 2014 campaign season. And in part one of a two-part series, news director Sally Mock talks with an Idaho Fish and Game official about why they want to eliminate two wolf packs in the Frank Church River of No Return wilderness. Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg is willing to negotiate a, quote, memorandum of understanding with the Federal Justice Department as a way of resolving DOJ's concerns about the way the county attorney's office has handled past sexual assault investigations. The offer is contained in a letter written by Van Valkenburg and sent to U.S. Attorney Michael Cotter. The Justice Department has reached settlement agreements with the Missoula Police Department and the University of Montana on how they will handle sexual assault allegations. Van Valkenburg refused to agree to a settlement, arguing DOJ has no authority over his office. The letter sent today repeats his assertion about that, and Van Valkenburg again asserts he'd be willing to go to court to challenge DOJ's authority. The county commissioners will ultimately make that decision if no agreement is reached. News director Sally Mock spoke with Van Valkenburg this afternoon about the letter he sent today and what he thinks will happen next.
Fred, I want to talk first of all about the memorandum of understanding that you propose to the DOJ. Tell me what you envision that being exactly, and how would that differ from a quote-unquote settlement?
Well, it differs pretty substantially. The memorandum of understanding that I'm proposing is that we would assist the Missoula Police Department and the University of Montana Office of Public Safety in carrying out their obligations under their agreements with the DOJ. We can do training for the police department and the UM Office of Public Safety. We've already agreed to kind of establish a very formal procedure with the Missoula Police Department as to how we review sexual assault cases, including having face-to-face meetings with victims, detectives, crime victim advocates, trying to get to a point where we make a decision on whether to prosecute cases within 2 to 4 weeks, depending on the type of review that the police department sends to us. There are, I think, a number of things that are very possible to do to, you know, make sure that Missoula has a much more coordinated system, one that delivers better services to victims without imposing requirements on our office from Washington, D.C., and huge financial burdens on Missoula County taxpayers.
By saying that these things are going to be done, is there an admission there that there were things that weren't being done that should have been?
No, not at all. But, you know, I think any institution can always do a better job than it's been doing. I don't think that there's anything wrong with what we've done, but as time goes by, sometimes there's higher expectations as to what services will be delivered. And you know, obviously, there are some people who must think that there was some kind of failing. But I don't think there was. But, you know, if you can do something to make people have more confidence in how you deliver services, then that's what you ought to aim for.
Your letter to DOJ, in no uncertain terms, continues to spell out your objection to their notion that they have any say over how your office does its business. But you're clearly, it seems in this letter, also trying to avoid any kind of litigation either from them against you or you against them. Is that fair to say, do you think?
Well, I think the county commissioners, for sure, want to give the DOJ the opportunity to try and reach an agreement that's mutually acceptable, not one that they are unilaterally imposing on us, as I think they did to the university and to the police department. The university and the police department virtually got nothing in their efforts to cooperate with the DOJ, and all they did was sort of get some good press that they had settled their cases.
You've given DOJ 2 weeks to respond, and then you say that the county and you will take them to court. Is that a hard and fast 2 weeks, or will you give them some?
To some degree, it's up to the county commissioners. I have asked the county commissioners to essentially authorize me to spend up to $50,000 to pursue a declaratory judgment action, and I don't have any great hope that the DOJ is going to suddenly come up with some proposal here that's going to be acceptable. I'd like to get going with this thing and get this matter resolved. They've let it just fester for over a year and a half, and they knew the very first day that they made this announcement that I was opposed to what they were doing. And if they really had the actual authority to do what they claim they do, I think they would have taken me to court within a month of the time that they, and I think someone has called their bluff, and they're not used to that.
Yeah, I've been speaking with Missoula County Attorney Fred Van Valkenburg. Fred, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Sally.
And in other news from around the state, a U.S. defense official says two Air Force officers at Malmstrom Air Force Base have been implicated in an illegal narcotics investigation. The defense official, speaking on condition of anonymity because he wasn't authorized to discuss the matter publicly by name, says both officers are ICBM launch officers with responsibility for operating the Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles and work for the 341st Missile Wing. The official says the officer's access to classified information has been suspended and the Air Force is investigating. The investigation is the latest sign of trouble for the nation's nuclear forces, which have been suffering under security lapses, discipline problems, and low morale. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel was at an Air Force missile base today to help boost morale. A head-on collision on the east side of Hamilton killed one person and critically injured another. The Montana Highway Patrol says a southbound pickup crossed the center line of the east side highway at about 5:30 this morning and struck a Northwestern Energy vehicle. The passenger in the pickup died while the driver was taken to a Missoula hospital with critical injuries. The driver of the Northwestern Energy vehicle suffered minor injuries. The names of those involved have not been released. The 2014 election season formally kicks off today. People running for statewide and federal offices and legislative seats can now officially file their paperwork with the Secretary of State's office. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us nearly 140 candidates put their names in today.
Candidate filing began precisely at 8 a.m. at the state capitol. And when Secretary of State Linda McCullough ceremoniously opens the doors, Helena Democratic State House candidate Mary Ann Dunwell starts ceremoniously clapping.
I was first one here, it appears, 7:30 this morning.
First in line to file, she's smartly dressed in a black blazer with a turquoise button-down shirt and matching glasses.
I love Montana. I care for my neighbors. I want to make sure Montanans have a voice in the people's house.
Right behind her, Billings Republican Senate candidate Don Roberts, he drove all the way over here on Wednesday night.
It's very emotional. It's heartfelt.
Secretary McCullough signs the candidate forms at her lobby's front desk. A plate of frosted red, white, and blue cookies waits there for visitors. Candidates don't have to file at her office. They can mail in their forms or file online. But there's a tradition here.
There's a bit of a ceremony, and it actually is a very exciting day. I have a lot of fun.
Both the state Republican and Democratic parties spread their message from news events in the Capitol Rotunda, though certainly not at the same time. About a dozen Democratic legislative candidates gathered, faulting the Republican-led 2013 legislature for turning away what they call good ideas. Most dramatically, Republicans' decision to turn away money to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Helena Senator Christine Kaufman.
To accept the dollars that Montanans have already sent to Washington, D.C., refusal to bring them back home and put them to work for our citizens.
She believes Montana can create better communities if more Democrats are elected to the state legislature.
And where Democrats have great diversity, Republicans right now have deep divisions.
She's referring to a split which formed last legislative session between conservative and moderate Republicans on many key issues. It's a split which Stevensville Republican Senator Fred Thomas does not deny.
We acknowledge that we've had some very difficult times.
But he says the party is trying to fix that.
Many of us are working concertedly, whether it be behind the scenes or whatever, to find the common ground, listen to each other.
Republicans did show unity with a much bigger news conference than the Democrats had. Culbertson Representative Austin Knutson says Montana voters are tired of what he calls failed liberal policies both in the state and in Washington, D.C.
The last few legislative sessions have seen Democrat bill after Democrat bill aimed at regulating, restraining, and in some cases even suffocating our job-creating industries.
Like oil, coal, and timber.
I'm sorry, but we can't all survive in Montana on elk antler furniture and huckleberry jam. We have to have real jobs in the state.
Legislative candidates for the first time are filing in their new districts, which were established in redistricting efforts over the last few years. This reshaping of legislative borders can change the dynamic of races. Great Falls Democratic Representative Tom Jacobson's district becomes more urban and 5% more Democratic as he heads into his reelection bid.
It'll help me quite a bit here. Like 5 points, 5 percentage points is quite a bit in any election.
So it helps some candidates, hurts others. And that's the same for communities. Butte Democratic Senator Jim Keene.
Butte got hit very hard in redistricting. We had 4 seats after the redistricting. We had 3 seats, and they split us up into different districts.
These new districts will be in place until 2022. County and city candidates are now able to also begin filing at their county election offices. Candidate filing for the 2014 election closes on March 10th, except for independent or other minor party candidates. They need to gather signatures to run for office, and a new state law pushes their filing deadline to June 2nd. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Research co-written by University of Montana scientists finds worldwide population decreases in 17 of 31 large carnivore species and their habitat range as well. The analysis was published today in the magazine Science. UM College of Forestry and Conservation's John J. Craighead Chair, Joel Berger, and Associate Professor of Ungulate Habitat, Mark Hebblewhite, co-wrote the study with several scientists from Australia, Italy, Sweden, and other American universities. Hebblewhite is currently on sabbatical and conducting research in Italy. He says the large carnivores at the center of this study include everything from lions, tigers, and cheetahs to wolves, bears, and even sea otters. Hebblewhite and his colleagues examined the global distribution of these carnivores. They studied not only where they're thriving, but also where and why they're declining.
Lions in Western Africa are approaching the endangered level, and they're dropping out from many, many countries. And with tigers, we've seen the same sorts of declines from 10,000 tigers 20, 30 years ago to less than 3,000 today. And the main reasons are very similar to the reasons why we lost carnivores in a lot of the U.S. They're because of overhunting, habitat loss, and for some species, because of the trade for medicinal plants, you know, properties from medicinal tiger soups and illegal trade in wildlife.
Hebblewhite and his colleagues say such population declines are not self-contained, that they'll have significant ripple effects. He points to the sea otter as an example.
When you have a system without sea otters, you basically have what they've called a sea urchin desert. So sea otters are prey on urchins, but urchins devastate kelp forests. And basically the system completely changes from one with abundant kelp, with sea otters, with some urchins, but immense potential to have nurseries for fish populations. And without otters, when you get rid of otters through trapping or over-harvest, you basically have a denuded sea floor with nothing living on it except sea urchins.
He says wolf recovery has already had important repercussions on habitat in Yellowstone National Park.
They directly kill and chase elk. But then as elk numbers decline or elk change their behavior and shift, and it depends, you know, which one of those two happen is, of course, a really important question. But either way, elk change after wolves recover. And by distributing on the landscape differently or by having fewer elk in the first place, there are fewer animals like elk eating aspen and willow, and so the aspen and willow have a chance to recover.
Hebblewhite says aspen and willow trees are extremely important for beavers, songbirds, and trout fishing. Wolf and bear recovery is nothing if not a politically charged topic in North America, but he says they're success stories nonetheless.
Lots of debates in Montana about whether we have too many wolves or not enough wolves, or whether we have too many of this or not enough of that. But we're in a very fortunate spot globally. We do have enough wildlife to argue about them. And I think our job in Montana is to, you know, help train the next generation of carnivore biologists and conservationists across the entire globe. If we want to have the same sort of successes that we've had here in Montana with wolves and grizzly bears, there's other species out there like tigers that really need to benefit from the kinds of lessons we've learned.
Speaking of carnivore populations, a separate study also involving Dr. Hebblewhite shows higher than expected numbers of adult mountain lions in the southern Bitterroot Valley. Researchers from UM and Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks started their population tally about 3 years ago.
There was a lot of concern about elk numbers declining. Of course, wolves had just recovered in the Bitterroot Valley, and a lot of the thoughts, including my own, were that, well, geez, I bet wolves have something to do with the elk declines. And so we're now in our third year of radio collaring adult female elk and elk calves. And in the first year or two, we were very surprised that most, like almost all of the mortality by carnivores was caused by mountain lions. And so that was a big surprise.
Newly refined DNA-based techniques helped the researchers determine a mountain lion population in the southern Bitterroot 2 to 4 times higher than initially thought.
Based on previous research, Montana Fish, Wildlife and Parks had estimates in the range of 30 to 40 mountain lions in the area, and we basically have estimated double that. And so at the very minimum, there's 62 unique lions that we've estimated in the southern Bitterroot, but it could be as high as even almost 150, 160 mountain lions. So that's a high number. It's high for the Bitterroot Valley, and it's high compared to other mountain lion population studies, and so it's going to be a little controversial because it's such a high number.
Hebblewhite stands by the results, saying the team kept finding new lions. He also points out there hasn't been a very high harvest on female mountain lions in the Bitterroot for about 10 years. Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is now in the process of developing lion harvest quotas for next season. Should a state have the right to hire a professional to kill wolves in a federally designated wilderness area to enhance the area's elk population for recreational hunters? As we reported yesterday, some conservation groups think not and are suing federal and Idaho state officials over Idaho's plan to track and kill wolves from two packs in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness in central Idaho. Tonight, in the first of a two-part series on the issues raised in the suit, News Director Sally Mock talks with the Chief of Communications for the Idaho Department of Fish and Game, Mike Keckler, about why Idaho last month hired and sent a professional hunter into the Frank Church to eliminate 2 of 6 wolf packs living in the Middle Fork of the Salmon River area of the wilderness. Keckler says wolves are taking a heavy toll on the resident elk population.
Our latest statistics show that over the last 10 or 12 years, the elk populations in this particular portion of the Frank Church wilderness have decreased by about 43%. In 2002, we had an estimated 7,485 elk in the Middle Fork, and in 2011, those numbers were down to 4,223. So it has been pretty dramatic, about 43% over that period of time. And there are several factors, but predation is certainly one of those factors. And that is one of the reasons why we've chosen to reduce the wolf population in that area to give these populations a bit of a break to enable them to better recover.
And how many wolf packs are in that area?
We have at least 6 packs in this zone and many others throughout the wilderness area. So the goal here is basically to remove 2 of those packs in order to lessen the impact they have on elk in that area.
Managing elk in the Frank Church, is that part of your state wildlife management plan? Because it is federal land, obviously.
Absolutely. We managed this area before it became federal designated wilderness. And we have managed the wildlife in that area since it became wilderness. We have throughout its history, and we have throughout the history of Idaho and Idaho Fish and Game in particular, which dates back to statehood. so, you know, we are charged with managing wildlife throughout our state, and that includes the wilderness areas of our state. And so we just see this as one more action in doing what our mission outlines, and that is managing wildlife in Idaho in order to create surpluses for hunting, fishing, and trapping.
Is this a popular hunting area?
It is a popular hunting area. Idaho is known as the wilderness state. We have more wilderness in Idaho than any other state in the lower 48. And people come from all over the world to hunt in the wilderness area and to spend time back there, not only to hunt, but just to view and experience the solitude that the wilderness provides. So, yes, it is a popular place to hunt, but it's also a popular place just to recreate. And people come, like I say, from all over the world to do these things.
Usually wilderness areas are not the most popular hunting areas because they're so remote and it's difficult to access.
Well, again, we are considered the wilderness state when it comes to hunting. And there are many hunters out there who are specifically looking for what you're talking about. That place where they can go, where they can get away from others and really experience an area that is reflective of maybe what the entire country looked like 150 or 200 years ago. And so they come specifically to experience that solitude and work harder to get the animals that they're after.
So the Frank Church is a popular hunting area in Idaho.
It is. I mean, but it is a difficult place to hunt. It's a place where more of the hardy souls, if you will, like to hunt and spend their time.
You mentioned earlier that Idaho Fish and Game has long managed wildlife in wilderness areas in your state, including in the Frank Church. Has that past management ever included reduction of predators, a state action to reduce predators?
Not specifically in the Frank Church, but we have done so in the Lolo area, which is just right on the Idaho-Montana border. A couple of years ago, we authorized an action there which removed 14 wolves. And we've said all along that any control actions like this would be focused on areas where wolves are having a particularly large impact, either on livestock and or other species. And so we're basically following through with what we said we would do, and we assume management. And in this particular area, the wolves are having an impact. It is a remote area. It's often difficult for hunters and trappers to get into, and therefore they haven't been quite as effective there as we had hoped. Again, this is not an attempt to exterminate wolves. This is just an attempt to bring the population down into better balance with other species, specifically prey.
Critics of the move, as you know, Mr. Keckler, argue that wilderness areas should create their own balance, that's the point of having a wilderness area, is that it will evolve naturally, and that if wolves are taking out more elk than have been there in the past, that's just a natural occurrence and should be allowed to happen because it is a designated wilderness area.
It is my understanding that when the wilderness was created, it was understood that there would still be wildlife management activities, not only permitted, but specified by the state wildlife management agency in charge, and that is Idaho Fish and Game. Because it is wilderness does not mean that the wildlife is exempt from management. We still have to manage the wildlife of the state for the benefit of the people of the state who own this wildlife, and that's what we're attempting to do here. There was never an exclusion of wildlife management in the creation of the wilderness areas.
The argument that it should be allowed to naturally evolve is something that the state obviously takes issue with.
Well, we do, because we manage the wildlife for the state of Idaho. The federal government manages the habitat, and that's the understanding, and that's how it works.
You do have a hunter in the Frank Church right now who is trying to take out how many wolves?
Well, as I understand it, the goal is to remove two wolves now, or two packs, excuse me. And your typical pack can consist of anywhere from four to a half dozen, maybe even a dozen members. So it's hard to say just how exactly, to pinpoint the exact number of wolves.
And he is there now trying to do that and will be there until he accomplishes that.
This individual is in the wilderness area as we speak, and he is an employee of Idaho Fish and Game. I want to reiterate the fact that when we took over management of wolves, we said then that any control actions would be focused on areas where impacts our greatest. And we stated that then, and we are carrying that out now.
Well, I have been speaking with Mike Keckler, who is Chief of Communications for the Idaho Fish and Game Department. Mr. Keckler, thank you so much for the information.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, in part two of our series, Sally talks with Tim Presso of the Bozeman-based Earth Justice Law Firm, who represents the conservation groups suing Idaho and the federal government to try to stop the eradication of the two wolf packs in the Frank Church Wilderness. Presso will discuss why they think the plan violates the government's duty to protect the wilderness character of the area. Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight, snow showers are likely with lows 17 to 24 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain. Snow is likely with highs in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect from midnight tonight to 11 p.m. Monday for the Rocky Mountain Front and eastern Glacier County. There's also a winter weather advisory in effect from 5 a.m. tomorrow to early Sunday for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight, there's a chance of snow with lows in the 20s. Wind gusts could be up to 55 miles per hour, increasing to 75 miles per hour overnight. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow through the day and highs 35 to 45 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 10 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow we'll also have a chance of snow, highs in the 30s, and wind gusts could reach up to 50 miles per hour. And now for the editorial comments of Jessica Cena.
Fracking, America's new F-word. Since the release of the film Gasland, the 60-year-old petroleum extraction process of hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking, has been lighting up the media like the flaming faucets used to scare energy consumers. Fracking, a post-drilling injection process that pumps pressurized water, sand, and publicly disclosed chemicals into tight formations several thousand feet below ground, is being used today with another innovation, horizontal drilling, to take America from energy scarcity to energy abundance. In today's climate of increased public involvement in policymaking, the proliferation of false information threatens the future of American-made energy more than any of the processes being condemned by misinformed and activist sources. Claims of contamination, flammable tap water, earthquakes, water shortages, and even cancer have been fact-checked and disproven by the top regulatory agencies and medical centers in the country. And yet, the controversy continues. Fracking bans proposed around the country have been based heavily on alarmist rhetoric and fear-mongering. For too long, industry has remained quiet, often choosing to remain hidden from the limelight that today many celebrities are rushing to be a part of, a limelight of activism, with the likes of Yoko Ono, Lady Gaga, and others speaking out against something they know little about, energy development. But the industry is waking up, realizing what influence social media now has on public opinion and public policy. The truth about oil, natural gas, and fracking in particular is beginning to make its way into the mainstream. And after 165 years, you could say it's about fracking time. Over 6,000 everyday products are made from petroleum, including cosmetics, synthetic clothing, rubber, and plastic. Petroleum is literally a lifesaver when you look at all the ways it is used. In heart valves, parachutes, seatbelts, and life preservers. It's in the roads and tires we drive on, even in electric vehicles. It's in water bottles, bike tires, and paved trails, affording those whose mobility is restricted to motorized means the ability to enjoy the great outdoors up close and personal. Agriculture and tourism rely heavily on petroleum. Just look at the diesel and fertilizer used for agriculture and the transportation which literally fuels tourism. Think about manufacturing, construction, and home building, and the fuel they require. And with each oil and gas job, three more are created indirectly. Jobs in retail, hospitality, food, and service industries. Tax revenue created by oil and gas jobs provide funding for public programs as well, including schools. There is a very real and personal side of the petroleum industry, too. one that is too often ignored. Seldom acknowledged for being the lifeblood of a community or family, the jobs and paychecks from oil-related jobs are exactly that. More than 25,000 jobs in Montana are related to oil and gas development. A job is a person's ability to put food on the table and presence under the tree. A job affords families and individuals the means to pay bills and shop locally, as well as the opportunity to recreate and travel. For students, innovation in the industry offers promise of employment and the means to pay off student loans. Montana's only petroleum engineering department has increased 10% every year since 2007, and the diesel program at Missoula College now has a waiting list of students. With resources in Montana, many people are finding work here without having to leave the state. Eastern Montana's unemployment numbers offer the most telling story of the positive impact energy exploration has had on job creation. So in spite of the fracas about fracking, the facts speak loud and clear. The truth about petroleum is a reflection of the miracle of American ingenuity, the engine of economic progress, and what opportunity looks like. I am Jessica Cena with the Montana Petroleum Association. Thank you for listening.
Jessica Cena is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.